The American dream has become a nightmare. Signs of the time are on cardboard, on corners in town. Like a cancer that's silently spreading, there's an unspoken fear. We're on our way down. We must take America back. Main Street to Wall Street, cities and states, Washington, D.C. Before it's too late, there's not long. We need leaders who lead us, not stick us and bleed us, then ransom our future and our children's, that's wrong. We must take America back as liberty weeps, our forefathers spin in their graves. Pray God will bless some way out of this mess. We must take America back.
We are back, second hour of the National Intel Report on this Tuesday, 26 November 2019. And I just love clips like this because it demonstrates that there's actually people out there thinking. And this one was branded interview with former black supremacist turned Trump supporter. Of course, he had to be a black supremacist to really be a wacko and support Trump. Here's the rest of what the man said.
We're living to survive. I meet him. The first time I really met him.
Let me skip ahead here.
Then I stood behind him. And the reason that will come to help deliver us out of the king of Babylon's hand. And that's Isaiah 45, 1 through 5. And guess what? Trump got, the press accuses him of all of those accolades. And he's not afraid. He won't back down. That's my man. And then you can't pay him off. So he's not found wanting. So therefore I stand behind him because he could have just lived opulently like Moses could have did the same thing. Well, what did Moses do? He took off his royal robe and jumped in the mud with us. And now he's called a deplorable with us instead of standing back and marrying Nefertiti and living an opulent life. He could have did that easily. He was living in Mar-a-Lago and having a ball. But he gave it up because he saw that his people, which is the black man and the white man, are being destroyed. And they said, well, he's a racist. Well, if he's a racist, why did Jesse Jackson thank him for helping him run for president and helping the Rainbow Coalition and help him get black people jobs for the last 30 years? Why did he help that Russell Simmons get financing to do Def Jam Records, out of which there would have been no Jay-Z? He helped Don King. I've seen him help black people, like the black guy that fixed his tire, didn't know he was in the car. He paid the man's whole mortgage off. He didn't have to do that. You know what I'm saying?
President Trump, they have asked you to be behind him in rallies?
No. See, in the beginning, it wasn't really like that. So what I would do, because she's been with me and they've been with me, I just go and go there. You understand? That's what I do. I go there. And they're not like the Democrats. I went to one of Hillary's events one time just so I could bash her because I despise her. And when I went there, I had a sign, but I had it sort of covered. And so they came up to me, hey, would you like to stand behind Hillary? So they were recruiting all the black people out of the audience, about 10 of them. I said, of course. So I said, oh my God, I'm going to get her. Somebody said, oh my God, that's Michael the black man. So they stopped him. That was the only way she escaped it. But you know what I noticed? They were recruiting. The Republicans are so over-righteous. And Republicans in Ecclesiastes 7:15 says, don't be so over-righteous to your own harm, for why shouldest thou die before that time? So this is what they do. They see you, but they won't say nothing to you. Like the last event, we had over 100 black people there. But they're all sitting on the fringes because they're so afraid.
Michael,
let me finish this with them.
Sorry.
They were so afraid to be seen that they don't even go in. And then the Republicans are so ridiculous, they don't go ask them to come stand behind.
So let me finish.
Your answer is about to be finished. So what I did when I saw them doing it, I would just go sit there, and they would be so glad they wouldn't say anything. And so I've been doing it for so long. So when I went there yesterday, I got there at 7:20 in the morning. I took a taxi to the thing. I got there around 8. So I was like 8th in line. There was already, people had been there since yesterday. So when we walked in, there was nobody in the venue. So what I did, I looked at the thing and I tried it out and I said, wow. And so what I did, I just walked up there. I said, I'm going to sit right here because I knew that was a good spot. And he said, you're going to sit right here? So I said, yeah. Oh, okay, okay. And nobody said nothing. They don't say anything. But they're so glad that somebody black is going to come up there. I don't know if they're really glad, but whatever it is, they don't say nothing. You don't say nothing, I'm not going to say nothing. So let's do this together. Yes, sir.
Yeah. Hi, Michael. Does the Trump campaign, does Mr. Trump know about your association years ago with Yahweh Ben Yahweh?
I really don't know if he knows. I haven't asked him. But, you know, Moses was accused of murder, but he was still the Messiah, and he still delivered us. They accused Jesus of murder. You press accuse us of all kind of stuff, because the Bible said in Revelation 12:10 that you would be the accuser of the brethren.
So you were not
to accuse
guilty.
Us before. Yeah.
I know that.
Right.
Yeah.
Then why did you ask the question?
If I may say, gods2.com, who pays for this? How do you travel around the country?
Oh, me. I raise my own money. I don't need you.
I travel around the country, too.
Yeah, you just pay. One time,
we cannot travel unless somebody's paying us.
What the reporter is trying to fish for is who's supporting you so we can go after and badmouth them. Wow. The state of journalism today. So the Republicans won't ask black people to take prominent seats and they got to stand on the fringe. They're not asking, and he says, okay, they're not asking. We're not going to ask. We're just going to do it. Well, hallelujah. Oh, boy. Paul Craig Roberts, that doesn't do interviews after dark. What? No. Whitehead and I got into it, and Mr. Whitehead, I don't think, is going to be doing any interviews with me anymore. Because I took the opportunity to tell him that I've been in his battle just as long as you have been, sir, and it's cost me a lot more. Well, he didn't exactly like that. At any rate, it doesn't matter. Former U.S. Attorney Joe DiGenova predicts that U.S. Justice Department Inspector General Michael Horowitz report on the Obama regime's FISA court violations and U.S. Attorney John Durham's criminal investigation of Russiagate hoax perpetrated by the CIA, FBI, the Democrat National Committee, and the prostitute media will be very bad for people in the Obama administration. It's going to be devastating. It's going to ruin careers. For the sake of accountable government, I hope that Mr. DiGenova is right, but I have my doubts. Cabinet departments and government agencies are not very good at investigating themselves. Attorney General Barr's job is to protect his department. He knows, and will be told often, that to bring indictments against Justice Department officials would discredit the Justice Department in the public's mind. It would also affect the attitude of juries toward the DOJ prosecutions. John Durham knows the same thing. He also knows that he will create a hostile environment for himself if he indicts DOJ officials, and that when he joins a law firm to capitalize on experience as a U.S. attorney, he will not receive usual favors when he represents clients against the DOJ charges. Horowitz knows that his job is to cover up or minimize any illegalities in order to protect the Department of Justice from scandals. In Washington, cover-ups are the rule, and the DOJ cover-up might already have begun. One sign of cover-up is to announce a future release date of the report. This has now occurred with the Horowitz's report on FISA violations. The purpose of such announcements is to allow the report to be discredited in advance and to be old news by the time it appears. And they call that getting ahead of the story, folks, as I've always said. If you can't beat it back, you can't make it disappear, well, you embrace it. You make it your best friend. You direct the narrative. And all the rest of that folder, all is just that. It's just lies. And see, we were the ones that first talked about this. Mm-hmm. Yeah, we get it. Another sign of the cover-up is the use of leaks to shift the focus from high-level officials to lowly underlings. And this has happened with the Horowitz report, which has leaked that a low-level FBI attorney is under criminal investigation for allegedly falsifying a document relating to the surveillance of former Trump campaign official Carter Page. 2016, according to the leak, the FBI attorney has acknowledged that he did alter the document. In other words, it seems we're being prepared for a false story that the plot against Trump originated in the lower levels and not with the CIA Director John Brennan, not with the FBI Director James Comey, and certainly not with the FBI Deputy Director Andrew McCabe, or certainly not with Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein, and of course it couldn't be Deputy Attorney General Sally Yates, and the rest of it just couldn't be. This is the way the cover-ups of the U.S. torture prison, Al-Gharib prison, remember that one in Afghanistan, was handled, and the My Lai massacre in Vietnam. Only the underlings take the hit as if they were in charge, acting on their own independently of their superiors, which is never the case. Another sign that the cover-up is in place is Attorney General Barr's assurance that Jeffrey Epstein, love this one, that... I'm sorry, folks. It's just when the lies are so egregious, it just, the bigger the lie, the more it makes me laugh. I mean, this is what we're reduced to. We got to come up with some big whoppers. Otherwise, people are just not going to believe the smaller ones anymore. Another sign that the cover-up is in place, Attorney General Barr's assurance that Jeffrey Epstein killed himself and that evidence to the contrary is just a series of coincidences that, misunderstood, resulted in a conspiracy theory. Barr claims to have personally reviewed security footage that no one entered the area where Epstein was imprisoned. Previously, we were told that the security cameras were not turned on, so what security footage did Barr review? Can the rest of us see that non-existent evidence? No. That's what I said yesterday. I had no idea that the 81-year-old, or soon-to-be 81-year-old, was going to include this in his article. But that was my question. How the hell do you review something that's non-existent? Barr also, in his pronouncement, evaded remarks of Chief Medical Examiner, who stated clearly that the damage to Epstein's neck is not consistent with suicide, but is associated with strangulation. And that could be a whopper too, folks. The guy laying on the gurney may or may not have been Mr. Epstein, and Mr. Epstein may or may not be dead. Who the hell do we ask? You want to call the FBI and ask them? Okay, you try them, I'll try the CIA. There was no reason whatsoever for Epstein to kill himself. He had so much dirt on the Western political elite that he could not be given his day in open court. So he was murdered? The question is, why was he picked up and murdered? Was he using the pedophile information to exact blackmail payments for those he had provided with underage sex? It is possible for an elite society to be more corrupt than the Western elite society is. Is that even possible? How can the West survive when its allies are corrupt beyond comprehension? That Epstein did not kill himself is completely obvious, so when A.G. Barr covers up Epstein's murder, this is an indication that he will cover up the military security complex / DNC / prostitute coup against Trump. From what I know of Washington, I'm certain that Washington, the cesspool of the world, will never rat itself out. And that is a true statement. All right, looking at more strategic culture blunders, Sprite. Their transgender ad proves there's a war on for children's hearts and minds and bodies. How many people remember the days when the purpose of television commercials was to sell audiences some newfangled product they didn't even realize they needed, as opposed to some dangerous agenda? It seems that we're losing those memories pretty quickly. The world of corporate advertising has finally crossed the cultural Rubicon. In a newly released advertisement, yet another major corporation has idolized a lifestyle choice, which naturally has absolutely no connection to the traditional nuclear family that has guided Western civilization through thick and thin over two millennia. Doesn't exist. The controversial ad in question focuses all of its fervid attention not on the product, but rather on promoting transgender attitudes among the impressionable pubescent teen population. This latest creation, born out of the cultural Marxist laboratory, which just happens to be the commercial for Sprite, a beverage produced by the Coca-Cola company, features several adolescents preparing for their attendance at some rainbow festoon event on the streets of a soulless urban jungle. In the ad, feels more like a documentary than a promotional commercial for carbonated sugar water. That's because no actor is ever seen quenching their thirst with a drink. Instead, the product has become the vehicle, a veritable Trojan horse for driving home a hugely controversial issue into the living rooms of millions of Americans. Note, anyone confused by what's meant by the term cultural Marxism may want to watch a brief segment of an interview with a late journalist, I would say murdered, Andy Breitbart. And Andy, Breitbart misses you because they've run off the rails. Who provides a compelling argument as to how and why the Western world is now plagued with stupefying political correctness and the social justice mindset. Here is the man speaking from the grave, Mr. Andrew Breitbart.
Segment 4, The Theory, of which you have more in this book than I'd expected. Righteous Indignation. A lot gets explained here. Marx and Hegel had paved the way for the progressives, who in turn had paved the way for the Frankfurt School, who had then attacked the American way of life by pushing cultural Marxism through critical theory. There's a lot going on there. Very briefly, what's the Frankfurt School, and why should anyone watching this interview care?
Okay, first of all, anyone that reads this book is going to laugh, and they're going to cry, and they're going to get Andrew in all of his zany different multiple layers. But there's one chapter that is like putting the medicine in the sherbet in order to get your kid to take it, in order to get rid of his fever. And to me, my one discovery, my one great epiphany, my one aha moment that I said, I got it. I see what exactly happened with in this country. The Frankfurt School were emigres from
Germany, Austria.
Well, Germany. Mm-hmm. It was the equivalent of this, the Hoover Institution. What the Hoover Institution is to Stanford University, the Frankfurt School was a think tank at the University of Frankfurt, and they were social scientists. Like Herbert Marcuse, Antonio Gramsci, Horkheimer, Adorno. These were all a bunch of guys in the middle of World War II who had suffered in Europe, you know, two world wars in a row, and they had been fighting, they had been fighting the Nazis, and they were trying to figure out another aspect of how to affect, how to spread Marxism around the world. You could go to Bolivia, you could go to Bulgaria, and you could go to the peasant class, and you could say, let's flip this place. The Marxist-Stalinist argument of getting the workers to get upset at the owners was very easy, but not in America, where the middle class was invested in their productivity, invested in the concept that they could have their own small little American dream, a white picket fence, that they could invent something and go from one generation being dirt poor to being an owner within a very quick period of time. And what these guys figured out when they came to the United States, and Adorno is the one that drives me the most crazy, he came out to California, and I think it was Bertolt Brecht, the East German playwright, moved to Santa Monica in the 1940s at the height of the Golden Age. Think about this. These guys left Nazi Germany and Mussolini's Italy, to come to California in the 1940s, and they lived by the beach, and they were depressed by the relentless cheeriness, the productivity, and the capitalism that they witnessed around them. And they came up with at the end of the day, we could call it cultural Marxism, but at the end of the day, we experience it on a day-to-day basis. And by that I mean a minute-by-minute, second-by-second basis. It's political correctness and it's multiculturalism. And what it took was this amazing concept of e pluribus unum, where everybody comes here and contributes to this, you know, everybody becomes an American and contributes, but we have a common culture, we have a common border, a common mindset. What they did was take the haves versus have-nots friction and translated it into oppressor versus the oppressed. And
this got taken up by faculties across the country.
That's the
point of the Frankfurt School and the progressivism.
They
becomes embraced by 60s
post-structuralism
academics.
Post-structuralism, queer studies, African American studies, all of that is pitting people against each other. It is anti-American to its core.
If Marcuse was the, I'm quoting again from Righteous Indignation, if Marcuse was the Jesus of the New Left, then Saul Alinsky was his St. Paul. Again, let me just put it to you in simple terms. Who's Saul Alinsky, and why should anyone watching this interview care?
Well, Hillary Clinton wrote her senior thesis on Saul Alinsky at Wellesley. Barack Obama is an acolyte of Saul Alinsky. He created the concept of community organizing. And what he did, as I argue in this book, is he took all of this ethereal claptrap, this Noam Chomsky-like jargon that the average person couldn't understand.
Herbert Marcuse is very hard to read.
Right, it's all impossible
all right.
to read. But he was able to translate this cultural Marxist down to a series of rules and a mindset, a warrior mindset, where the critical theory was like, take on your enemy, take him directly on, destroy that person. He applied critical theory down to the street war level, and I would argue that the Katie Couric's of the world, the Chris Matthews of the world, Rachel Maddow, and Keith Olbermann, unbeknownst even to themselves, are studied in the tactics of Alinsky.
Now back to that Sprite ad. An apparent mother, the word apparent is necessary since the term gender has become an entirely fluid concept defined solely by a person's feelings, which may change at a moment's notice, by the way, opens the action to the sound of melodramatic melodies as she applies eyeliner on her apparent biological son. Cut away to scene two. Yet another apparent mother helps her apparent daughter wrap herself in a corset to conceal the fact that she has breasts. Heaven forbid. Whether a mastectomy is on the horizon for the girl, together with a lifetime commitment to testosterone injections, the audience is none the wiser. Next, an apparent grandmother dotes over her apparent cross-dressing grandson as he dons a mauve wig before wiggling into an uncontained excitement together with Baba at their reflection in the mirror. I'm struggling to imagine a grandmother that would ungrudgingly accept a scenario, but in the fizzy pop reality world of Coca-Cola Company, anything, I guess, is possible. Now, what's missing in this corporate-sponsored trip to the far side of insanity? Well, for starters, common sense. After all, it's really wise to award hero status upon pubescent teens over their sexual orientation, which is oftentimes confused at best. Teenagers are already greatly influenced by a myriad messages they're bombarded with daily over social media. Do they really need a Fortune 500 company promoting a lifestyle, namely transgender, which carries it with an entire rainbow of untold risk? The liberal media rarely reports it, but there are thousands of youth right now attempting to reverse the bodily harm which they have done to themselves by trying to physically become the opposite sex, which is, it needs to be clarified once and for all, absolutely impossible. Oddly, Western society has long condemned the practice of genital mutilation in other less civilized cultures. yet somehow believes it's acceptable for children to sacrifice body parts and ingest powerful hormones in some dangerous quest to eradicate the sex they were born with. In other words, biology and the doctors who assigned them the wrong sex at birth got it all wrong. What really matters today, at least for the cultural Marxist warrior, is how each individual identifies with their true gender. Now, not only is the Coca-Cola company permitted to promote an unhealthy product without a warning from the Surgeon General that swilling soda drinks on a daily basis greatly increases the risk of diabetes, it's allowed to endorse a transgender lifestyle that may result in the unwanted loss of both life and limb, literally. You know, this kind of takes on the connotation of real child abuse, doesn't it, folks? Now, once a person undergoes the removal of the breast or penis, for example, it's exceedingly difficult to turn back. The video will display any illusions about gender affirmation operations being an easily reversible process, as some people, many from the medical community, have suggested. And here is the doctor talking exactly on that subject. Well, okay. We'll leave this to your imagination because the damn video is just too long. Sorry, I misread it. I thought it was 16 minutes, and it's an hour and 16 minutes. Sorry. Second, the agenda. The ad contains no apparent sign of fathers. Which, let me stop and digress here. Have you noticed the commercials lately? Yeah. It's the husband that's confused, doesn't know what to do, and the wife comes riding to the rescue, and he's in the background, not even in the foreground, but he's just this almost forgotten image that's some kind of bumble stump that doesn't know his proverbial golf ball from a hole in the ground. The agenda ad contains no apparent signs of fathers who we may assume are still trying to escape from the hellscape of a recent Gillette ad. And by the way, I got 1.5 million thumbs down on YouTube and counting that lectured men for their so-called toxic masculinity. Funny how one corporation outright trashes males, predominantly white men, incidentally are coaxed into doing the right thing by their minority brothers, while the latest corporate message fails to feature a single father figure. So we can see that the assault against Caucasian males is not only happening regularly on Netflix, the movie Bird Box is a good example, if you need any proof, but the warped message is now going mainstream in TV commercials as well. Finally, it must be asked why these corporations, anxious to cash in on the woke mania, continue to push an agenda as opposed to selling a product. After all, one of the first efforts by a corporation, which just happened to be a Coca-Cola's competitor, Pepsi-Cola, to ride a wave of social justice movement that was met with abysmal failure. The video is not even any longer featured on Pepsi-Cola's main website. Does it sound reasonable that these companies are using a highly controversial subject to promote a product in order to appeal to a tiny faction of the population? That seems like a foolish strategy to win over some social justice warriors to Sprite when just as many consumers will now be tempted to boycott the product on principle. Thus, an argument could be made that the real motivation for companies like Coca-Cola and Gillette to air such advertisements, which are invariably aimed at the youth, is to set in motion a total and complete change of mindset with the youth themselves. In other words, these corporations are complicit in the game of social engineering, and the cost of their bottom line is irrelevant. One possible motive is to create a weaker, less masculine society, or an even more dependent consumer. Or is there something much deeper and darker at work here? Personally, I suspect something far more sinister is guiding the decision-making process that gives green lights to such projects.
You are tuned in to the Republic Broadcasting Network. Visit our website by going to republicbroadcasting.org.
The The reviews for Extendivite are amazing. Here are some from Amazon. By Christine, great for heart palpitations. By Anne, before I started using this product, every afternoon, my ankles and my hands would be swollen. That doesn't happen anymore. So if that part of their advertising is true, I have to assume that the rest of it is also. Not to mention that when I had my yearly blood test, only a few weeks after beginning to use this product, my cholesterol had dropped over 30 points. I'm going to continue to take it. By Croc, I love this product. It really works. By Brad, works great, thank you. Tell us your story. Get your Extendivite today. To order, call 1-877-928-8822. That's 1-877-928-8822 or visit heartdrop.com.
Extend your life with Extendivite.
Homeowners, if your lender has gone out of business or sold your transaction to another lender or servicer, you may be the victim of a wrongful foreclosure resulting in the loss of your home. If you've already lost your home, are in foreclosure, or even in good standing, you can challenge the mortgage transaction's illegal issue and your property can be restored to you, and your foreclosure can be stopped or reversed and the mortgage transaction declared unenforceable. State laws, U.S. title codes, the Uniform Commercial Codes, and U.S. Supreme Court rulings have upheld that defective mortgage documentations can reverse or stop foreclosures and enforce property title claims in favor of the homeowner. We are having successes in stopping the process of foreclosure, the enforcement of the foreclosure judgments, the sale of property, and evictions after the sale. We are not attorneys, and we don't give legal advice. We are a professional team of legal researchers, providing forensic mortgage audits and expert witnesses. We have the knowledge to produce the evidence and enforce laws regarding your legal issues. We've been in business for 12 years without a complaint. Consultations are free, and we provide a free title search to confirm if your mortgage has legal defects. Please call 855-253-3748. 855-2 keep it today.
Corporate media dominates the American opinion. Finding independent voices that counter this avalanche is becoming increasingly difficult. With the endless corruption running rampant throughout our government, independent voices are needed more than ever to battle the offensive against our freedoms and liberties. As a listener of RBN, no one understands this concept better than you. Now it's up to you to do your part. The time has come for you to take action and begin broadcasting the truth to hundreds or thousands of people every month. Sound impossible? Quite the contrary. With pointed slogans from LibertyStickers.com, you can reach countless sleeping Americans unaware that they live in a real-life wonderland. LibertyStickers.com has a huge inventory of political bumper stickers and messages that reflect the truth about our government, our politicians, and the future of America. With so many in stock, there's one perfect for you. Visit us today at LibertyStickers.com. Again, that's LibertyStickers.com. Do your part. Your voice is important. Let it be heard.
In some of these controversial commercials, it usually starts with a mirror. An individual staring back at the reflection of someone who they think they know. But in all likelihood, they don't. The ancient command, "Know thyself," was believed by the wise Greeks to be so crucial to the full development of the person that the motto was engraved on the famed temple of Apollo. Much of Western society, however, the inheritors of Greco-Roman political and cultural traditions, has abandoned that sound counsel, becoming more alienated with their true selves than ever before. I suspect that this is what the globalists want, the rainbow flag of hyper-sexualized culture displacing the national flag, the intensely individualist lifestyle supplanting any connection to the nuclear family tradition, and Western society becoming a bubbling cauldron of dreams and desires so ridiculous that nothing short of martial law will be able to control it. Now, with all of that said, folks, enjoy that Sprite, will you? Me? I prefer Sprite over 7-Up, but I'm going to be drinking 7-Up. God. and LBJ and the USS Liberty. A look behind the scenes showing how LBJ moved his pawns, including the men aboard the USS Liberty, on a global chessboard as he schemed to win re-election in 1968. And the four faces of the Supreme Court Justice, Abe Fortas, simultaneously counseling LBJ, liaising with Israel, and member pro tempore of the National Security Council. One instance of how Lyndon Baines Johnson's delusions surfaced occurred in 1965. While flying high on Air Force One, when he proclaimed to several reporters on board that he'd become the most powerful man in the world, as he announced to them that he was basically now the king of the world, Johnson had invited four reporters from the press pool into his suite to share cocktails with him in his quarters. They were flying high above his domain, which was now the entire world. He was in a bubbly mood, and this phase of the mania was strengthened with each drink from his glass of Cutty Sark Scotch. The guy couldn't even pick a good scotch to drink. He's got to drink well stuff. Great. As he sat in his huge, elevated, custom-designed leather chair, the crew, by the way, dubbed it the throne, with the reporters arrayed around him in their smaller cloth seats, he decided to remind the select group of reporters how fortune had smiled on him that day, to be in the presence of the single most important person in the world. And then suddenly, Mr. Johnson declared, "Look around the world. Khrushchev's gone. Macmillan's gone. Adenauer's gone. Sergei's gone. Nehru's gone. Who's left? De Gaulle?" AP reporter Frank Comier said that Johnson sneered as he uttered the French president's name. Then, leaning back in his massive throne chair, LBJ thumped his chest in Tarzan fashion and loudly bellowed, "I am the king." Well, Lyndon Johnson was known arguably more than any other president as one who moved his subordinates like a king moves its pawns into other positions as it suited his future needs. This was illustrated by such examples of Arthur Goldberg, who in 1965 had been happy to have a safe and secure position on the Supreme Court, well, until LBJ decided he needed to have him become the ambassador to the UN. That was because of Johnson's awareness of Goldberg's strong attachment to Israel and its Zionist leadership, which would become a great need when an operation that would become known as 1967's Six-Day War was then being planned and would suddenly materialize just two short years later. Questions posed by Nicholas Katzenbach 40 years after the fact. Nicholas Katzenbach, who was moved by President Johnson from the Justice Department and appointed as an Assistant Secretary of State a few months before the Liberty attack, may have inadvertently exposed, revealing clues as to what was really going on behind the scenes during that Six-Day War and the USS Liberty attack on June 8, 1967. Within his 2008 memoirs, Some of It Was Fun, Working with RFK and LBJ, he cited a number of points that still concerned him 40 years later, which never made any sense to him. There is no indication that Katzenbach had any foreknowledge of the attack. In fact, there's numerous indications that he was nowhere near being in the loop. He stated that most administration officials, including Navy personnel, did not believe the Israeli explanation that it was a case of mistaken identity. And he acknowledged that Johnson accepted the apology for political reasons, but felt that Israel should have offered the families generous compensation, with an implicit understanding that they would be reimbursed. Moreover, Katzenbach admitted that the State Department had angered many in the Jewish community through its issuance of a statement of neutrality, which was considered in retrospect as being an unwise move. That neutrality statement began during a State Department briefing when some of the officials became giddy over Israel's successes, as described by Grace Housel in her article, How LBJ's Vietnam War Paralyzed His Mideast Policymakers. With a wide smile, Eugene Rostow said, "Gentlemen, gentlemen, do not forget that we are in a new neutral world. Shortly thereafter, press spokesman Robert J. McCloskey repeated words for the reporters. This statement caused so much consternation among the Israeli leadership and within the White House, according to the memoirs of Joseph Califano. The reason it was such a political problem that reached white heat was because it could be interpreted as an invocation of the Neutrality Act, which meant that Israelis would be constrained from raising money in the United States, and that might prevent the United States from shipping supplies to Israel. Califano said that Abe Fortas was among those who expressed his concern to him about that very issue. However, it was in the context of having deep reservations that it applied. Now, behind the scenes in the 303 committee in April of 67, Abe Fortas, a sitting Supreme Court justice, was also simultaneously serving in three other unofficial positions. One of Johnson's primary advisors as a liaison between Johnson and Israeli leaders, and attending meetings of the National Security Council, thereby becoming directly involved in the planning of the Six-Day War. The paradox created by Justice Fortas in facilitating Johnson's efforts to subvert constitutional, legal, moral, and ethical rules of conduct, and assisting that the president to commit U.S. military might to support a war of aggression by the U.S. ally on its neighbors should not go unnoticed, as it inherently proved to have been the case for some five decades. Even as he played these multiple roles, he seemed oblivious to the innate conflict of interest they invoked. Fortas had previously been Johnson's personal lawyer for over 20 years, including having played a primary role in Johnson's theft of the 1948 senatorial election, and being his chief collaborator in the months after JFK's assassination to squelch the multiple Senate investigations into Johnson's criminal past. Throughout all of it, he was just a personal witness to Johnson's long history of criminal activity, clearly becoming one of Johnson's primary enablers and sycophants. As detailed in his book, Remember the Liberty, preparations for the attack on the USS Liberty were delegated by Johnson to the 303 Committee, a subgroup of National Security Council named for their elegant corner office of the executive building where it met. It was located physically next door to the White House, but figuratively an extension of it, reserved as a second office assigned to the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, according to Richard Helms. That committee was simply a device for examining covert operations of any kind and making a judgment on behalf of the president so he wouldn't be nailed if the thing failed. But under Johnson, the function of the group was much more proactive in creating plans than merely reviewing the products of others. In 1967, the 303 Committee was composed of the Undersecretary of State for Political Affairs, Foy D. Kohler, formerly the ambassador to the Soviet Union, the Deputy Secretary of Defense, Cyrus Vance, the CIA Director, Richard Helms, the Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, General Earl Wheeler, and the President's National Security Advisor, Walt Rostow. This committee controlled all covert CIA operations. And regardless of its name or the President, the committee was always directly under the control of the president to whom it served, and was, therefore, as James Rustin, the New York Times columnist, observed, above even the Joint Chiefs of Staff, charged with approving intelligence missions all over the world. Clearly, and implicitly, it should have been noted as well, it was also above the CIA and its director, who served on it merely as just one of the members. The preponderance of this evidence indicates that the 303's committee planning, in collaboration with Israeli leadership for Israel's war with their neighbors, beginning shortly after the 1964 elections, by the way, included a subplot to have Israel attack the USS Liberty, which was added at Johnson's direction, for purposes that only deluded the psychotic mind could conjure. By sacrificing his own ship and all the men aboard, through an attack by an Israeli defense forces, but putting the blame on Egypt. He could join Israel in the war, kill his hated enemy, Egyptian President Gamal Abdel Nasser, and win the appropriation of, the admiration of voters who had come to dislike him for handling of the Vietnam War, thereby ensuring another landslide election in 1968. And LBJ's psychosis is well documented. Though not openly discussed in polite social settings or anywhere within the mainstream media, through statements from people who observed him in meltdowns during much of his presidency, including especially the run-up to the Liberty incident, President Johnson suffered many instances of such a tortured mindset, including numerous instances of psychotic behavior, as described by several of his former aides, military officers, and others who had the misfortune of serving him. Together with Israeli representatives, the men on the 303 committee created a plan called Frontlet 615, and that was staged for June 15th that included a number of subparts, one of which establishes these plans began their development no later than the last quarter of 1964, or the earliest months of 65, since elements of the larger plan were already operational in the latter part of 1965. Proof of the involvement of the 303 committee in planning the operation was inexplicably exposed by LBJ Library and what appeared to be a series of inadvertent errors, as described by WikiLeaks, though they missed the significance of their findings. In 1988, Lyndon Johnson Library declassified and released a document from the USS Liberty Archive with the top secret eyes-only security caveat. That was document number 12C, sanitized and released 21 December 88. This memorandum, for the record, dated 10 April 67, reported a briefing of the 303 committee by General Ralph D. Stickley. According to the memo, General Stickley briefed the committee on a sensitive DOD project known as Frontlet 615, which is identified in the handwritten note on the original memorandum as submarine within UAR waters. When the war was started 10 days before its scheduled beginning on June 15, 1967, it threw Johnson's plot to sacrifice his best spy ship into disarray. He had planned it to be a pretext to join Israel in its fight against LBJ's mortal enemy, Mr. Nasser, or Nasser as it's pronounced, who he thought was a dangerous puppet to Moscow. To ensure the war did not end before the Liberty arrived in its position, Johnson had ordered UN Ambassador Arthur Goldberg to resist efforts to obtain a ceasefire at the United Nations, where a disagreement regarding the language about a definition of territories had materialized. But three other points raised by Katzenbach must also be considered in relation to tracing the events as they unfolded in the White House. Whether taken separately or together as a whole, these confusing and contradictory statements should have raised multiple red flags. Katzenbach stated that Israel's initially refused to pay anything toward compensation for the victims because it was a regrettable incident. Others made similar statements, including George Ball, who also noted that Israel's apology was reluctant and graceless, and that the reparations for the families of the men killed and the injured survivors were slow in coming. Ball also admitted that Johnson had tried to downplay the enormous damage to the ship and 34 dead and scores of other wounded sailors through an elaborate charade to silence the crew, but acknowledged that the sordid affair was too damaging to ever possibly be concealed. His poignant conclusion was that the Israelis decided that if they could get by with an attack of this enormity, they could get away with almost anything. Though Ball would eventually be proven right, the fact is that for 13 years, the atrocity was well hidden, and the story would unravel very slowly over many decades. Even now, most Americans have never even heard of it. If Israel alone had been at fault for this egregious, inexplicable error, given the close dependency it had to the United States as being its primary ally, then the logical presumption would be that they would have certainly understood the need to at least act contritely, to acknowledge and apologize for the error, and then make a generous financial settlement with the victims of such an incident involving their most important patron. They should not need to be coerced into doing that, even if it was all for show, just to get the monkey off their back, but according to Katzenbach, George Ball, and many others, that was not happening. However, there are three counterpoints to the premise of Israeli diffidence. If the Israeli officials felt that they had been put in an impossible position in the first place by the American president to attack his own ship for his own political purposes, and that they were being forced into having to accept the blame and bite the bullet when things went wrong and the ship didn't sink, then it follows that the reaction was not as insensitive as Katzenbach and others have interpreted it. Perhaps they felt that he had been had by the psychotic American president, and they did not relish the idea of then becoming the scapegoat for something they, specifically the godfather of Israel, David Ben-Gurion, had even desperately tried to warn against. Ben-Gurion furiously betrayed Yitzhak Rabin so severely for acquiescing to it that it caused Rabin to suffer a nervous breakdown just days later, forcing him to sit out the six-day war that he had helped plan. Looking at it from that prism, their resistance to quickly make amends and paying retribution to the victims seems a bit less unreasonable. And that leads to a clear understanding of why Mr. Katzenbach struggled with these questions for at least half of his life, as well to an epiphany of what actually happened. Pending release of all the files that remain closed on both continents, this issue will remain, as Winston Churchill once famously said about Russia, a riddle wrapped in a mystery inside of enigma. Yeah. Yeah, just show me the records. Yeah. Well, we can draw our own conclusions. Thank you very much. Another point, by the way, that Katzenbach made was President Johnson curiously did not want to anger the Israelis any further. This assertion, considering the circumstance, is quite astounding, given that, even under the ostensible cover story, that this incident was merely a case of mistaken identity, still puts the onus on Israel to make matters right, at least to act contritely and with an adequate level of remorse for the awful mistake. Could Israel have been used their operational knowledge of the plot's origin, likely the source of their anger over how the story was being handled, maybe as blackmail? Finally, I didn't know Mr. Epstein was active back then. Finally, even more confusing than any of the other points Katzenbach stated was Johnson's decision to make little effort to obtain a ceasefire for several days. What possible explanation might there be for LBJ wanting to delay a peaceful solution? Was it because of his re-election hopes, and that, at the point, his plot to sink the Liberty had not been completed? This may be an explanation as to why Johnson and Goldberg at the UN deliberately stalled the efforts going on by the United Nations from June 6th to the 8th to secure an early peace, because he still wanted desperately to buy time for having the Liberty in place for the attack and, after it had sunk, to blame Egypt as the pretext for him to attack Cairo with nuclear weapons. It is proof of the pudding that Johnson had been obsessed with this desire to seize the opportunity of joining Israel in an all-out attack on Egypt, that the bombers were already on their way to Cairo when they were called back, after it became clear that the Liberty had not sunk after being hit by a torpedo. Only that random synchronicity, what some would call divine intervention, forced the abrupt cancellation of the clandestine operation, thus preempting Johnson's high-risk, psychotically induced attack that would have likely provoked a response by the Soviet Union and the potential use of nuclear weapons with it. Coming on the heels, maybe, World War III. Considering all the questions raised by Katzenbach in his memoirs 40 years after the attack. The rationale stated above seems to be the only plausible possible explanation, that this was all part of a grand move in the chess game the psychotic president was playing as he acted out his role as king of the world. There's more to this, folks, but we're winding this edition of the National Intel Report down. But suffice to say, I had heard this before, and many other people alluded to this. What I did not know was that Johnson had already had planes on its way to Saudi Arabia to level their country. Now, remember, this was the man that gave us the Vietnam War. Remember that? Mm-hmm. That one kind of blew up in his face. People in Washington, D.C., Secret Service could barely contain themselves. When people were trying to climb over the White House fence to get at the president, they wouldn't stop this insane war in Vietnam. Man. I will not seek, nor will I accept the Democrat National Convention. He was saying on that day, I've used up all my lucky cookies here. I'm out of here. So what did Johnson do? Came back to Texas, grew his hair long, and died. You never heard any interviews, had you? After he left the White House. Well, there's good reason for that. He was one paranoid king of the world. He had figured that, well, a lot of this information had gotten out, and we still had something called journalism in this country, that he might have to answer uncomfortable questions. Ergo, never give another interview. Don't get taped. Don't make any public appearances. Just don't. Go back to Texas, grow your hair long, and die. Thank you, Lyndon Baines Johnson. And I know what you're thinking. Did he actually have Kennedy killed? I don't know. He's dead now, but one could suppose. Kind of like that famous photo on board Air Force One, where Baines Johnson's got his hand on the Bible, and to his left is the First Lady, and there was some guy in the background giving somebody a good old wink, like, yeah, looks like we got it pulled off. There might be one of the reasons why all the information about the JFK assassination can't be released for another 75 years. Because the stank coming out of this grave of one Lyndon Baines Johnson is still as putrefying as ever. Dead men tell no tales, do they? All right, folks, thank you for being here today. Tomorrow, Susan Lindauer will be my guest tomorrow. Be with me. She'll be with me for 2 hours. You make sure you're there tomorrow. I thank you for being here today.
Tired of being lied to by mass media? It's growing more and more apparent today that news is received less and less through standard media outlets. Even with a growing audience every day, RBN is beginning to direct more efforts into social media. Social media and the use of the internet is fast becoming the primary source of people for news, regardless of demographic. RBN has set out to provide some of the best news on the internet through republicbroadcasting.org and also has begun to use the tools to our advantage by way of social media. Republic Broadcasting is now operating a Facebook page to function as yet another avenue to have our collective voice reach new audiences across not only America, but across the globe as well. The Facebook page features not only news, but also an RBN player to listen to our broadcast. Get involved by visiting facebook.com/republicbroadcasting and liking our page and share it with your friends and family. because you can handle the truth.
You're listening to the Republic Broadcasting Network because you can handle the truth.